Last week, we started talking about the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and we're going to do more of it today. Good morning and welcome to Talk Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. On the night of March 23rd, 1989, a loaded tanker veered from the shipping lanes and headed straight for the rocks. It never turned. Shortly after midnight, it ripped itself open. 20 years ago today. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, toll free, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. Is the lesson learned? Can regulation erode again on Talk of Alaska statewide?
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Fostering safe, connected schools is a foundation for academic achievement through annual school climate surveys. Information at aasb.org. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
Well, we've got a new panel of guests. It was fascinating last time around, and it should be fascinating, too. We don't really need guests because the listeners are more than capable of filling up a show like this, and there is so much to be said. It's odd today. We're watching basically our old 20-year-old story hit the national news again, and that's bound to prompt mixed feelings in Alaskans. I have someone on the phone from Juneau who had some first experience back 20 years ago, and that is Greg Erickson. He's, of course, the founder of the Alaska Budget Report, but at that time, he was working for the Fish and Game Department and was the economist in charge of the spill and restoration assessment. Is that right? The damage assessment and restoration?
Damage assessment and restoration, yes.
Well, Greg, tell me, that went on for quite a while, and it was kind of interesting scientifically because it all had to be kept secret because it was litigation, right?
That's right, and there was a source of considerable tension between the scientists and the lawyers and the bureaucrats. It was sort of a three-cornered kind of game with actually many, many more interstices and corners than that with all the bureaucracies involved. But I should clarify one thing. When the spill occurred, I was senior economist in the Office of Management and Budget working for then-Governor Steve Cooper. And it wasn't until October that I took over the damage assessment and restoration effort, which at that time was really focused on building the scientific case to support litigation, natural resources damages litigation against the perpetrators of the spill.
Now, when Wally Hickel was elected, he elected to settle that, I guess, in about 1991, so it's like 2 years later.
Yes, that's true. Settled it for, should say that the governments settled it because it wasn't just Wally Hickel, it was also the federal government.
Right.
And they settled it for the natural resources damages for almost $1 billion, 900 and some million, and they've gotten a little extra since in interest. So they've had about $1 billion to basically spend on restoration.
Well, last week we had Charles Wolforth on, and he's kind of writing a book about, I guess you could say, human responsibility, human factors, and the spill plays a large role in this. And he had some kind of harsh assessments of things, including the science. He said he thought that the science, looking back on it, was flawed. And from your point of view, I'm wondering if you would agree, because it would appear, I mean, I know these scientists, it seemed to me that they do good work, but, you know, when you're trying to prove damages, aren't you also kind of spinning the science in a way?
Absolutely. I think that's a valid criticism. I think there was lots of very good science done. I think there was also quite a bit of money in retrospect. You look back and you say that really wasn't probably worth it. There was a tremendous concern on the part of lawyers with documenting every dead duck and oiled salmon egg, and so the science was, at least at the outset, directed really by the litigation, and I think that explains in some ways a lot of the problems that were associated with the science effort. I think later on, though, the bureaucracies got their act together quite a bit better and produced some pretty good science.
Yeah, good. I appreciate that assessment. Greg, I want to get back to you in a moment. The telephone number to join our conversation on Talk of Alaska about the Exxon Valdez oil spill of 20 years ago today is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. One thing that happened as a result of the spill in Congress was the passage of OPA 90. That's the Oil Spill Prevention Act, I believe it's called. And it mandated the creation of regional citizens advisory councils. And we have the staffer for the Prince William Sound RCAC with us now, Stan Jones. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stan.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, except for struggling with a spring cold that's gone on far too long.
Well, today's your day to talk. You better take care of your voice.
What a day to have a cold.
Yeah, right. Also with him is Sharon Bushell. Sharon's work is known to many Alaskans because she has been collecting oral history for many years. And Sharon, you also were involved in an oral history project that you and Stan will be talking about. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
Yes, I was hired to go get the oral histories of folks all across the spectrum who were involved in the oil spill, from people who cleaned beaches and cleaned birds and otters, all the way to people at the heads of agencies, people, small business owners, Exxon folks, Alyeska folks, and took a long time to do, and it was quite a feat.
Well, I would think it was. You divided the interviews. Is that right, Stan?
I was the editor of the book, and I wrote what you might call the connective tissue between the sections of interviews.
So it's all her interviews.
She did all of the interviews with one exception. One of them was done by one of our board members in Kodiak. And also, one of the things that appears in the interview sections is really a speech written by a fellow named Walter McGannick back in 1989. And it's a beautiful speech, usually just referred to as the Death of the Waters speech. And Walter died in 1995, but this was such a terrific speech that there were parts of it that fit in and sort of looked like an interview, so we used that as well. But all of the rest of it is Mrs. Bushell's hard, hard, hard work, and brilliant work, I think.
Thank you, Stan.
How many hours of recordings did you make?
Oh, gosh.
Inconceivable amounts
Steve,
of recordings.
That well, that's is a question that I did not anticipate.
That's my specialty.
Yeah. Well, many hundreds, certainly.
Wow.
It seems more like thousands, perhaps millions, but it was...
All right. Here's a harder question. How many tears fell during that?
Buckets. It would have required a bucket brigade to haul them away.
Sharon told me during the process that in most of the interviews, there would come some point where the interview subject would just kind of break down and have to stop for a while. I mean, these emotions are raw and close to the surface even yet.
Okay. Whose idea was it to approach Joe Hazelwood? He's never talked to the press. He didn't even talk to the judge.
It was... Well, this idea of having this oral history was actually born at one of our Citizens Council board meetings in Seldovia in September of 2003. So as you can see, this was not an instant book. It was a long, agonizing process to find the money. And then when we finally got it early in 2007, it was may not seem like it considering how much time there was, but it was also kind of a rush job to get the book, you know, research written and out by now. Anyone who's ever been involved in book publication knows that usually from the time you submit the manuscript to the publisher, you're looking at another year to 18 months. In this case, it was 6 months from the time we gave the publisher the manuscript. So from the start, we knew we wanted to interview the people who just were closest to the oil spill, and Hazelwood was always at the top of the list. We wrote him a letter from the council saying we'd like to interview you and got no response. Then when we hired Sharon to do the interviews, she had the list of the people we wanted to interview, and she and her husband, Johnny Bushell, went to work on Hazelwood and finally talked him into it. And I mean, and Sharon can tell you a little bit about that story because it's kind of an amazing story.
My husband and I left Homer, which is our home, and were en route to New York to interview several people there and then on to Washington, D.C. to interview several more, the primary interview being Joe Hazelwood in a small town outside of Washington, New York City. So once we landed in New York City, we looked on our email, and Joe had changed his mind once more and decided he had a good reason for this. But
and I can talk a little bit about that after she finishes this story.
Suffice it to say that he had decided that he was not going to meet with me. But when the day of the meeting came, it just seemed to me like there was nothing to lose. So we got in the car and drove to the little town where he works, went to the law office, the little town where he lives, went to the office where he works, and the woman paged him. I turned around, and there he was. I took one look at him. We made eye contact, and I knew that he was going to talk to me, and he did for three consecutive days and numerous phone calls, the last of which was just a few days ago. So he was ready. There were some things that he wanted to say, and there was one major thing that he wanted to say.
That would that be the apology or what?
That's right. It was the apology. It was very important to him that he say that, and I think that he wanted, this is perhaps one of the reasons that he hasn't given interviews too much. I think he wanted to say that to an Alaskan. And perhaps someone who was representing the RCAC was also important to him. But it was an incredibly poignant moment. We were sitting side by side in a conference room. His hands were on the table, and they were shaking. He was trembling all over. And when he said how sorry he was, I just naturally covered his hands with mine and said, "Joe, I am nobody in particular, but I am an Alaskan. And as an Alaskan, I accept your apology." And we both had to struggle with that moment. That was a tough moment.
Well, that's an interesting point for our listeners, I think, whether how they feel about this. If they do, that would be an interesting question at 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. He's still in touch with you.
He is. He will accept my phone calls. And
there's kind of an interesting story behind that. About a month ago, I was contacted by one of the television stations in Anchorage, and they said they wanted to interview him and weren't getting anywhere. And could we put him in touch with him? And I said, well, Sharon has the contact information. I'll talk to her. And so she did call him and talk to him, and he told her he didn't want to talk to the TV stations, and that little part of the thing is something I'd like Sharon to tell, because it's actually pretty pointed, and it bears on what she was talking about before.
Yeah, please do.
Oh, he said that he had everything that he had told me. He didn't have anything else to say.
He said everything he wanted to say was in the book, and that was it. Wow. I was going to talk a little bit about why he canceled that interview.
Yeah.
After she got back to New York, she and Johnny arranged the interview before they went, and he canceled it. And what happened was this. I was at home on a Saturday morning. This was in early February of last year, and Sharon called from New York, and she said, "Stan, did you guys put something on your website about the oil spill?" And it turned out we had. It was soon after we filed our friend of the court brief in the Exxon Valdez punitive damages case. In that brief, the lawyers did allude to Hazelwood's drinking and also quoted from an old song called "What Do You Do with a Drunken Sailor?" And so I said, yeah, we put something on our website. And Sharon said, did it mention, you know, drinking and this song about a drunken sailor? And I said, yeah. She said, well, Joe read it and he canceled the interview. So Sharon being Sharon, you know, she's like a bloodhound or a ferret or something. Once she gets on your trail, you're doomed. So as she described, she went in cold and talked him into it.
Get some eye contact.
Yep. There's no substitute for FaceTime, actually.
No.
We forget that in this digital age.
Well, what struck me, the apology, I would have felt I would have had very odd feelings if there weren't an apology, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But what struck me is where he says there are answers to your questions, but they're not the easy answers. People are going to take the easy answers instead. And, boy, that's a book. I have a feeling that's a book.
You're right. I was just thinking about that yesterday and thinking perhaps I need to make another phone call to Joe real soon.
Yeah, because there are – in one way we know the answers. We have a timetable. But the very central point of why he left and left it to Cousins and why Cousins couldn't figure out what he was doing – we don't really have the answer
to
that.
Kind of an enduring mystery. And Cousins, by the way, would not talk to him.
Cousins is
They went to his door in New Orleans and basically got
If I were him, I would be a destroyed human being. I mean, he was pretty destroyed when he was talking to the NTSB.
Yes.
What a horrible thing to have on him.
And Gregory Cousins, for people who may not know the subject as intimately as we do, was the third mate on the Exxon Valdez and was actually on the bridge and in command at the time it hit the reef. Hazelwood came up just as it hit the reef, but basically Cousins was running the ship when it happened.
Well, now I want to steer a hard left here, or maybe a hard right.
As long as we don't go hard aground.
Greg Erickson, you're sitting here listening to all this, and I'm sure it's striking you as well. You know, from your position, do you think that we are responding creatively to this trauma we had 20 years ago?
Well, I think that if you look overall at the what we had to begin with in terms of resources and the challenge that faced society when the spill occurred, I think you have to say it's a mixed bag. Certainly, there were long overdue changes in the way we regulated the transport of oil across our seas and elsewhere, for that matter. And I don't think a lot of that would have happened nearly as quickly if it hadn't been for the spill. I don't think you can sum it up in one word. There are other areas where it's pretty clear that we haven't done all that we should have. As you mentioned, as we discussed earlier in the program, there's been quite a bit of waste, I think, in the course of this whole process. And you have to come up with a mixed verdict. And in some cases, I think you have to say the verdict is still out. You know, we still have federal law governing these kinds of accidents that really doesn't mesh very well with the reality of nature and our harmful impacts on it. That's something I've thought about for years, and it's I guess one of the things that you get when you have a democracy. You get legislation and laws that represent political compromises, and they are often imperfect, just as humans who fashion them are imperfect.
Well, you know, yesterday we talked with Don Young. And he said, oh, they won't be able to pull the escorts. He says, we won't even need to legislate on that. Stan, that probably of interest to you. The RCAC is concerned about this, right? That basically, now that we have almost all the tankers double-hulled, there really isn't a legal requirement for the escort tugs to go with them.
It is a huge concern for us, and it's probably the biggest priority that we have at the moment. And we are trying to do what we can to make sure those double escorts continue. There's a resolution that's been working its way through the legislature that puts the Alaska legislature on record as supporting the concept. Probably under the existing federal law, the state doesn't have the authority to do it. Probably be preempted by federal power. So we think we'll end up at the federal level. But for now, we're trying to get this resolution through the legislature. It passed the House a few days ago and went to a hearing before Senate State Affairs this morning at 9. And based on the signals we had going in, I think it probably passed State Affairs easily. And next it'll go to the Senate floor. And so once we have the legislature on the record, and by proxy the people of Alaska on the record, we will probably take it to the federal level. we don't take it for granted that there won't be an effort to downsize or reduce or eliminate the tug system, because there have already been proposals to do that from the oil industry. So we think that some kind of firm, written, unbreakable commitment is necessary, and it just seems like we're going to end up in federal law when it comes to that. So we were happy to see Don support the idea of the tugs in concept, and he did say, as I recall, legislation if necessary. So that's a good sign. And the Daily News this morning ran an editorial supporting the preservation of the dual escorts as well.
Greg Erickson, when you think about the part of your job was damage assessment, and another part was restoration. What we saw when the litigation was settled, and there was $1 billion for a trustee council to spend, there was always this sort of tension over how much of it should go for science and how much of it should go for habitat acquisition, which actually meant when the Alaska Lands Act was passed, there were a lot of native inholdings that were important habitat areas that this money could be used to purchase and that way preserve as public lands as opposed to native lands. And how balanced do you think that process ended up? Did we get restoration, I guess, is the basic question.
Well, I think you have to understand that restoration is kind of a concept that isn't really well understood in the context of science, because one of the things that I certainly came to understand as the person designated in the state to be responsible for this effort on the state side was that the whole legal system regarding oil spills is based on the notion that nature is in some kind of equilibrium, and that if humans didn't disturb it, it would be fine. But the truth is that nature is always changing, always evolving. For example, the uplands around Prince William Sound were, at the time of the oil spill, still very much influenced by the uplift that occurred in the 1964 earthquake. And habitats were changing, flora and fauna and benthic creatures were moving into new habitats, and moose and wolves were changing their ranges in that area. It wasn't a stable system that you could somehow recreate the status quo ante. You can't go back in and do that. And yet the law sort of says that you're supposed to spend all this money to do that. And in many cases, it's foolish to try to do that, because it wouldn't happen in nature if the spill hadn't occurred. You wouldn't be going back to the status quo ante even if there hadn't been a spill.
Yeah.
So
how do you feel about, they used it for fixing erosion problems on the Kenai River? Now, clearly that's done by, boat wakes and too much fishing, too many fishermen along those. that's not the spill, but yet there's, a no net loss or factor.
Well, I think you have to take a practical view towards these sort of things. There's a pot of $1 billion there, and a whole bunch of it, only about $400 million went to land acquisition, and almost $200 million went to reimburse the lawyers and the scientists and the damage assessment people and myself, people who earn good salaries like myself who are with the bureaucracy, and almost $200 million went into monitoring, doing science on the species and habitats that were injured. I'll take the herring in Prince William Sound. The herring have never recovered after this spill. And if you go to anybody in Cordova, I'm sure they will tell you and believe fervently that the spill was the cause of the demise of the herring fishery there. But if you ask the fishery scientists to try to prove that in court, it's going to be very, very hard, because there's just too much noise in the system. There are too many other confounding influences that could have also had an effect on the herring. And it's not entirely impossible that the herring fishery might have collapsed even if there hadn't been a spill. So Does it make sense to pour additional money into trying to figure out how to whether the spill was responsible? Does it, and how much is it worth to try to restore a herring fishery if it turns out that it would cost hundreds of millions of dollars to do that? And these are real difficult questions. And as a practical matter, if you can find something that really does clearly do the environment some good, like eliminating the damage to the river banks of the Kenai, probably makes some sense to go ahead and do that. And there's the lawyers invent these concepts that allow you to get away with things that you probably couldn't get away with otherwise. And they say, well, it's an alternative resource. You're substituting this benefit for one that you can't produce directly. But I want to say one thing about the results of the spill. One of the really great things about the response to the spill was the creation of the citizen advisory committees. That really institutionalized in a very important way the public concern about these issues and gave it some resources. And I don't think that we'd be nearly as well off if that little provision in the spill legislation hadn't passed, because these gadflies who watch and investigate what the oil companies are doing with our environments and our resources wouldn't be around if it wasn't for this. So I think that's a real shining example of doing it right.
All right. Well, I imagine Stan agrees with you.
I do, and it's been very very interesting to me to watch the maturity of the RCAC. I came to RCAC in 1997, which was 8 years after the spill, and I had covered the RCAC a little bit as a reporter at the Daily News and had a vague but favorable impression. And one of the things I wondered about when I came here was something called regulatory capture, and that's a subject I wrote about right after the oil spill. It refers to the fact that the industry and its regulators spend a lot of time together, tend to go to the same schools, the same conferences, read the same journals, and so on. There's something of a revolving door. A lot of people in the agencies go to work for the industry when they retire or want to move up and have higher pay and better benefits. And as a result, they come to think alike. And it was that mindset, I concluded as a reporter, that was partly responsible for the complacency that led to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So my big question was, well, gee, you have this citizen council here, which is just a pack of gadflies and critics and people thumping their chest and so on and saying, make it better. Are they going to get captured too? And my question was whether there was anything structural about these RCACs that would let them preserve their independence. And so I took the plunge and came to work here, and now I've been doing it for 12 years. And I'm convinced that the way the RCACs, at least the one I work for, which I know best, the way it was set up actually does seem to do as much as is humanly possible to guarantee the continued independence and autonomy of this kind of structure. And the two or three elements are, one, guaranteed funding through a contract with Alyeska Pipeline, which was one of the reasons I was skeptical about the concept. But the contract guarantees funding, and that's about it. It gives Alyeska essentially no control over the makeup or operations of the council. And the other thing is the fact that the council does not get to pick its own board members. The governor doesn't pick any board members. No member of the federal Congress or bureaucracy picks our board members. We're made up of member entities like the city of Kodiak and the village of Tetitlik and the Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association, and they pick their delegates to our board. So somehow it all seems to work, and we haven't been captured yet that I can tell.
Yeah, theoretically, you actually have no power, though. I mean, you basically are kind of like the conscience factor, and if you don't get any press, maybe you're not effective.
Well, that is a very interesting point, and I think I'm going to say something that's going to sound like something would come out of the mouth of a Zen monk or something. And I think that the fact that we don't have any power is, in fact, our greatest power. And by what I mean by that is, if we actually had the power to make regulations, levy fines and all of those things, it would set up a kind of process of accountability and review and opposition that would basically turn us into another Coast Guard or DEC with all the attendant problems. The fact is we're advisory. And that gives us a measure of independence and kind of distance from the thing and perhaps a lack of identifiable self-interest that I think helps preserve our credibility and, again, that independence. And it's a fact that we don't get much press, and there's a good reason for that. And since I'm the press guy at the council, I probably understand this concept as well as anyone else. The reason we don't get much press is that we start from the inside. We talk to the regulators, we talk to the industry, and if we can get them to do things our way, then of course we don't go to the press and raise hell. And often as not, when they do decide to do things our way, we issue a press release congratulating them on their sound environmental stewardship. If they do the right thing, we're happy to give them much or all of the credit, as the case may be. So we do go to the press if we need to, but if we can make the outcome be what we want, then we don't go to the press.
Okay, you guys, you've had your say, and now we're going to go to the phones, and they're all jammed up. And we'll get right to them as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood, and together looking toward a bright future. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Well, it was 20 years ago today, probably just about at this time, that Claire Richardson was filing the first story from Valdez, letting Alaskans know that there had been an oil spill in Prince William Sound. We're looking back 20 years and through the succeeding 20 years and trying to look forward as well to what this episode, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, has meant to us and will mean to us, and where are we going to go, and are we at risk of our vigilance eroding. Let's go to the phone. Shannon joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Shannon.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks so much for hosting this show and for taking the time to focus the program today on this really important 20 years later after the oil spill. I'm calling from Homer kind of on two counts. One, I was a senior in high school here. I was 18 on the morning of March 24th, and I remember that morning and getting the news of the oil spill the same way I remember September 11th. I have that kind of ingrained in my memory, getting that news and feeling like, oh, my God, this is major. This is huge for Alaska, and it sticks with me. It's still a really strong, powerful feeling that I equate with that September 11th feeling I had, remembering exactly where I was and who I was talking to and where I was sitting in early bird economics class at Homer High School. But my family that summer helped make homemade log booms with a lot of other volunteers here in the Homer community, trying to protect Kachemak Bay and trying to protect our bay of Chinapoot Bay where we live. And it was a time when I think there was a lot of pain and concern. And I think it's so important that we remember this 20 years later. And I'm calling also to let people know statewide about what's going on here in our little town of Homer as we remember the 20-year anniversary. And the Pratt Museum here, our small local museum, is doing some really important stuff this week. And I want to invite people here on the peninsula and here in Homer or from around the state to come down and visit us here in Homer and see what we're doing at the Pratt Museum. We have an exhibit that's opening today on the 20-year anniversary called Remembering the Spill. 20 years later, and it's an artist exhibit, and it's opening tonight on the anniversary, and then we're having a candlelight procession through our community of Homer for commercial fishermen and anyone and everyone in town that was affected by the spill. We're doing a candlelight procession through town to remember tonight, and then on Thursday night here in town, we're having a presentation by Craig Matkin, who's a whale researcher and biologist. He's doing a presentation here at the Pratt Museum on whales, wildlife, and the effects of the oil spill. And then Friday night, kind of along a different line, the Salty Dog Saloon in Homer and the Pratt Museum are co-sponsoring Stories of the Spill, and it's kind of an opportunity for people to get together and have a beer and share their stories and remember what happened here 20 years ago. So I just really feel that it's important that we never forget this, and I have little children now, and I feel like it's really important that I have them understand the importance of that this could happen again. And as the gentleman earlier were speaking about, I think it's really important that we support this idea of having the tug escorts and continuing tug escorts, and, you know, double hold tankers is only the beginning. There needs to be tug escorts, and I applaud the work that so many people around the state are doing with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council and others to work to protect Prince William Sound and to protect Cook Inlet, because this could happen here in our inlet as well. And I think it's really important that we have involved citizens and oversight. And today, I think, is a day to remember. So thanks for taking the time, and I invite you all to come to Homer and join us in our events here at the Pratt Museum. And also, there's an exhibit coming up this summer here in Homer with Linda Smoger, a photographer who's doing a show called Remember Mars Cove. And Mars Cove was an area that was heavily oiled, and a group of volunteers came out and cleaned up the beach, and Linda photographed it, and there was a big piece on APR in this morning about that by Casey Kelly, and we have an exhibit here at the Pratt this summer on that. So lots of things going on, and I think it's really important for people to stay involved, and thank you.
Yeah, Shannon, I'll always remember the tale of the log booms, and I think it can't be really retold often enough what people tried to do, you know, just out of their own inventiveness when nobody but them saw that oil coming right into Cook Inlet.
And, you know, there are several interviews in the book with people who were involved in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And specifically, there's one with Billy Day, who was part of, you know, a major soldier in the battle for Mars Cove.
Indeed.
Right.
And just for the record, I don't – have we told anybody the title of this book?
Please do.
Just briefly.
It's
The Spill, Personal Stories from the Exxon Valdez Disaster, and you can find it on Amazon or on the website of Epicenter Press, which is the publisher. And I also should say that most of the stuff we're talking about here today is documented in detail on the website of our council, and that is www.pwsrcac.org.
All right.
Enough horn tooting.
All right. Shannon, thanks for joining us from Homer.
Thank you very much.
All right. We go to Sean now, who joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sean.
Thanks, Steve. Your program is always too short, and it should be on every day. You do great work.
It would drive me nuts.
Well, I wanted to thank your guests for coming on. It was a real poignant story with Joe Hazelwood, and I've always thought, and more so recently, that he was basically a scapegoat for this disaster. And the real crime was that, and this goes into really the arguments that were made before the Supreme Court, that I followed the work of Greg Pallas, and he's talked about the fact that there weren't any containment booms that were promised and contracted. There was no spill response team. They were all let go. The spill response barges were actually iced in and in dry dock. And then the radar that was supposed to be in use for these tankers leaving the port of Valdez, the Exxon Valdez's Rakus radar, was broken. And it wasn't disabled and wasn't turned on, and no one was trained to use the thing because they were cutting costs. And I just look at what they argued, and I think, you know, they kind of brought on the argument for this 19th century maritime law because they focused their argument basically around the myth of the drunken captain, when there are so many other things at play here. I mean, if these things were contracted and there was a compact between, for instance, the Chugach natives and the Port of Valdez, then really, without these things in place, no tankers should have been leaving Valdez for, it sounds like, months.
Yeah, there is a... Yeah, that you're really opening a can of worms on that whole area of the Supreme Court ruling. I mean, the minute that a majority of the court decided they could apply maritime law, they could pretty well decide, say whatever they wanted, because there's hardly any precedent.
Well, in this case, if you look at what this Supreme Court decision and the impact of it, I know that's probably not the focus of what you're doing today, but it relates to the Exxon Valdez because it's such a landmark case that, you know, from now on, corporations and with Pebble Mine looming can create these environmental catastrophes and write them up as the cost of doing business. And over 100 times, Congress has overturned Supreme Court decisions. And if that's not a route we could pursue, then maybe perhaps an appeal to the International World Court to get some justice finally. Although I doubt any of that will ever happen.
All right, Sean. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's try. Gary joins us the program from Valdez. Gary, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Hello, Gary. You're still there? Ah, we've lost him. Well, good. Then we can go back to our to our oral history. Mm-hmm. So were there people, Sharon, that you interviewed that didn't make the book? And could you make another book?
Well, I interviewed just over 100 people, and we ended up with 62 stories. So, yes, there were some people who did not make the book. But that is not because their stories were not well told or important. That was because basically they were stories that were repeated. So in deference to having a book that didn't weigh 10 pounds, we had to cut back and make some hard choices.
Yeah. You know, in a way, our decision to try and get this published through an ordinary publisher imposed a healthy discipline on us. We could have produced a 600-page book, but instead we produced a 288-page book that, you know, works like any other book. And it was really important to us to produce a book that an ordinary person could read and not have to think they need to know a lot about the oil spill or they're going to have to read a lot of technical stuff about the oil spill. I had a call from a reporter the other day who had been assigned this book and called me up to interview me about it. And she said that when she got it, she said, oh, no, not another Exxon Valdez book. But then she said when she read it, she was really moved, and it was fairly clear during the interview that she was deeply moved. And I thought maybe I was going to have Sharon call and talk to her about her trauma from reading the book. So it is a really accessible, easy-to-read book. And if you think it's just too dense a topic to get into, this is the book for you, and I say that not because I want to sell a million copies, but because of the reason we decided to do this at the Citizens Council. We realized that time was running out to preserve these memories forever, and that's what we wanted to do as one facet of our effort to institutionalize all the lessons from that oil spill.
In reading it myself, and I haven't read all of them, but I was amazed at the number of things I'd forgotten from 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
me too. I was a reporter at the time, and I thought I knew the subject, but
reporters are kind of professional forgetters in a way.
Brain overload.
What did you forget, Steve?
I forgot the details of the Sawmill Cove.
Huh.
The way that the Park Service people responded, I had kind of, that was all got foggy in my mind, who some of the people were. Hmm. There's a few of the things.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we're talking about is the Exxon Valdez oil spill 20 years later. Your call is welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. We have an email response here at talk@aprn.org. And this was basically reacting to last week's remarks by Charles Wolforth, who this writer says, Charles was mostly correct when he said that there was not a single act but a systemic failure by all parties involved that caused the Exxon Valdez grounding, and then goes on to the subject of deregulation. And saying that it was really understaffing, and we shouldn't lose track of the fact that Exxon had been stretching its crew too thin on that vessel, and that's why Cousins was up on the bridge instead of Kunkel, who was supposed to be there but mm-hmm. was too tired.
Right.
So, you know, that through the email from Bill. And let's go to Lauren, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Lauren.
Hi. Yeah. I thank you so much for the show, and I'd like to thank Sharon. This book, I haven't gotten a look at it, but I'm really looking forward to it because it sounds like it was a very direct person-to-person, a lot of emotion written in this book, and less about, not so maybe much about all the science. And so it sounds like it's a really neat book. And I wanted to say that when I worked on this, I talked last week, I worked on this bill of commercial fish, but my other background was I was a, after this spill, I became a merchant marine able seaman, and I actually worked on the escort tugs for Crowley Maritime in and out of the Sound, and even worked on the oil skimmer vessel, the Valdez Star. And I was impressed a lot with the drills they did there and in the Sound between the fishermen and that vessel and the barges. And I was really curious. I haven't been out there in a long time. I've since gone back to commercial set net salmon on and off and left that world. But I'd like to know if they're still doing these spill responses as heavily as they were doing back in the early 90s when I was on the spill. And one other thing I want to mention and say is that I worked as a marine mammal observer the year after the spill. And one thing that I feel is that there's all these scientists out there the year after the spill and fishermen trying to fish. And I was mostly on gillnet boats, about 45 that I collected data from. And I'm thinking that a lot more, it would have been nice if there would have been a lot more studies in direct, with direct interviews with fishermen and really use it as a science. Because they really noticed a huge change in the Sound the year after the spill. Some of them have been in the Sound for 30, 40 years in Copper River Flats as well. They know, and, you know, you can get all the science you want, but I think not enough was paid attention to documenting the science of observation of fishermen that have been there and their.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's kind of a culture clash. It's a little bit less of a culture clash now than it was then. They're more comfortable with this anecdotal and this the social aspects of the history and how to get the metrics out of that is the main problem for scientists. They always need to measure everything. But there's been progress made on that front. As for that other one, I want to go to Stan about that. They're still having spill drills, yes?
They are still drilling, and we like that and monitor the drills. I don't know if the count today is the same as it was in the early 90s, but it's still going on. And the fishing vessel program is still a key part of the response system. There's about 350 vessels enrolled in it, and we pay a lot of attention to that. From time to time, there are issues between Alyeska and the fishermen about rates and so on, and that's not under our direct control, but we do what we can to facilitate resolutions of those kind of things, and so the system continues.
Well, the way I understood it, back before 1989 on the spill, basically Alyeska was a puppet of BP. And it was always BP people that ended up running it, and they did whatever BP told them to. And if BP were to say, we want you to spend less money, they would spend less money, like they did with the ballast water treatment plant, for instance. It's my impression that that changed after the spill, that basically BP cracked the whip, and they have continued to insist that Alyeska be more responsible.
Well, the governorship structure of Alyeska is the same as it was. It's controlled by the owner companies, the oil producers on the North Slope. And so Alyeska is, I don't know how many people know this, Alyeska is a nonprofit corporation, much like RCAC. All right, not much like RCAC, but we're both nonprofit.
With more money.
Yeah, a lot more money. So they have to do an annual budget battle, like any nonprofit, to get their money from the owners. And I think that the cost pressures are still there. The owners are always looking for ways to cut costs, And in a capitalist system, that's a fact of life. Corporations maximize profits by reducing cost and increasing revenue, and we just have to accept that as the environment in which we function. And I mean that by – I mean us as individuals and RCAC as an organization. So Alyeska, I think, is a better company today than it was in 1989. Part of that is because of changes in laws and regulations that make them do more than they used to do. I think internally Alyeska is also a better company than it was in 1989. We interact intimately with Alyeska all the time, every day at multiple levels. And it seems to us that the cultural values we see inside Alyeska these days are the cultural values we would want a company like Alyeska to have. And we hope that continues. We'll do everything we can to make it continue. And if it falters, we'll say so. But when people are doing something right, we want to say that too. And these days, Alyeska is doing a fine job.
Sharon?
I have a suggestion to our listeners, and that is this. If your experience is like mine, when you talk to people who live outside, if they remember the Exxon Valdez oil spill at all, their memories are dim and their misconceptions are many. So I think that once you read this book and enjoy the stories and get a better understanding of this event yourself, I think it would be a great idea to mail it to your cousin in Oklahoma, Arkansas, California, Tennessee, Washington, D.C., any place, and help these folks understand what happened and what is continuing to happen today in regard to that.
That's Sharon Bushell on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by TelAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at TelAlaska, on the web at telalaska.com.
We're talking about whether capitalism always is going to cut costs, and it's up to us to be vigilant or not. Greg Erickson in Juneau listening, the economist and the spill damage assessment person. What do you think? Do we sort of need that counterbalance, don't we?
Absolutely. We can see I'd say the worst part of the damage assessment and restoration effort is directly a result of the fact that there was so much money floating around and there wasn't really any easy way to put a metric on what was usefully done with it and what wasn't. I think that the trustees have done a pretty good job of working through that issue over the years. But there's still people who feel there are too many scientists out there just watching the nature heal itself. Mackay Campbell, who was Commissioner of Fish and Game under Governor Murkowski's, tried at one point to dissolve the trustee council and divide the money up among the various between the two governments. That idea provoked quite a bit of outrage and didn't go anywhere. But I think most even those who oppose that idea would recognize that this kind of bureaucratic organization isn't the ideal sort of situation to have in terms of monitoring. And I think perhaps the model of the RCACs that we have in Prince William Sound and also in Cook Inlet might be a better approach to take in the future. Campbell, I disagreed with him on his proposal for sure, but he had a point, and I think that critters were damaged during the spill, as he said, and so forth. But he said he didn't know of any scientists who were damaged, and he didn't see any reason to spend money on scientists.
Now, I did see a scientist that was bitten by a sea otter. That was a modest proposal that Mackay made, wasn't it? Let's go to Jane. Joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jane.
Thank you. Last week, your show was focusing on heroes of the oil spill, and it was a very emotional show, and there were some tears shed here in Kodiak after listening to it and talking mostly about on-site heroes during the spill. But I'd like to recognize the heroes throughout our region that felt hopeless during the oil spill and didn't feel like on at the time that they could do anything that was meaningful. And so some of our heroes have created some programs here in Kodiak, and one that I would like to highlight, a local resident, Susan Payne, felt hopeless. And she is the instigator and founder of our annual Kodiak Whale Fest, which celebrates the migration of gray whales by Kodiak Island and, in turn, all the other whales that call Kodiak their home. And it's still a very popular venue that continues to this day. So education is such an important part, and there's a lot of heroes out there who may not have gotten their hands on oiled seabirds or in buckets of oil, but their contributions and their heroic efforts to start things that keep a positive celebration. And I was pleased that the gal from Homer called in and their celebration of the art and things that are coming out of this bill. So I just wanted to take note of those people whose contributions are still continuing today.
Thank you. That is well noted. I remember when 9/11 happened, a most compelling story here was that there was a river of blood. Everybody wanted to give blood. The blood bank was glutted with blood. Because people felt they had to do something. And I remember after the spill, all these people that wanted to do animal rehab. I mean, thousands and thousands. I mean, they drove up the Alcan Highway. They flew. It was so important them to be able to do something. And it's very good that you bring up that you still can. Sharon, you probably agree with that.
Indeed.
So you have some of those people in your book, right?
Oh, yes. The book, as I say, covers the spectrum of people who left their homes, left their children in the care of others to go out and work up cleaning beaches and under some really heartbreaking conditions, particularly in the native villages where their way of life was endangered, if not changed forever.
Yeah. Well, we've reached the end of our time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us and for your effort in this. I hope that these interviews of yours have some kind of ongoing life. It just seems that everything was cut down so short for this book. It would be great if they were someplace where people could explore them.
Not only did we have to leave out some interviews, but almost all were cut. I know one was cut from 12,000 words to about 1,500, so there's lots more out there.
Were there tears from Joe Hazelwood?
There were, yes. Okay.
How about now? It must be a tough day for him now.
I think that he has a lot of sorrow. He's a good person, and he has a lot of sorrow.
Thank you. Sharon Bushell, Stan Jones, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Greg Erickson, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Gooseberry Peter, Lynn Anderson, and Pat Yak. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the great land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska, on the web at telalaska.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.